Lecture 3, Ancient Egyptian Thought.
Hello again. I'm glad you're back. Last time, I tried to cover 700,000 years of history in half an hour. Right? Understand, it's totally inadequate. Prehistorians do courses that cover an entire year on the prehistory of Egypt. So I tried to do the best we could in 30 minutes, but you should go on and read more about the area. It's important. Now, let me say what we'll do today, and then I'll try to do it. What I'd like to do is cover ancient Egyptian thought, specifically mythology, but I'm going to cover more. I'm going to cover mythology, religion, and philosophy. Three different kinds of things, three different kinds of thinkings, and my hope is that at the end of the lecture, you'll know the difference between the three, and you'll be able to see what part they played in the ancient Egyptian world. Now, let me say something about what's in common for the three. Mythology, religion, and philosophy all try to answer the same kinds of questions. They answer non-empirical questions, questions that you can't answer by looking, seeing, observing. For example, is there life after death? Everybody wonders about that. And philosophy tries to answer it, religion tries to answer it, and mythology tries to answer it, but in different ways, and we'll see those ways. Another question, typical, non-empirical, philosophical, religious, mythological question, how did the universe begin? Everybody wonders. These three disciplines try to answer those also. So there are lots of, existence of God, the big one. All three cover it, but they do it in very different ways. And that's what I'm going to try to show today, the differences. Now, let's start with mythology, because this is the one that the ancient Egyptians certainly did the most of. Now, first let me say something. Mythology tries to answer questions like, is there a God? Is there life after death? How did the universe begin? But it's not to be taken literally. Mythology gives you stories. You're supposed to listen to them very carefully. Don't take them literally, but you're supposed to get the message. That's the crucial thing. There is a message that you're supposed to get. If you listen carefully to the myth, you will learn about the beginning of the universe, how it began. If you listen carefully, you will learn about whether there's a God or not. You will find out if there's life after death. But you can't take it literally, the story. So there's a message, but it's not literal. It's different from a fairy tale, for example. That's just a story you listen to and doesn't necessarily have a punchline. Myths always have a punchline. Now, also, when do myths take place? They take place in what's called primordial time. Time before time began. Now, it sounds like a contradiction, of course. But what we mean is, don't ask historical questions of mythological characters. For example, remember when we talked about the Bishop of Usher trying to figure out exactly when the universe began by using the Bible? Well, the Bible is religion. That's not a myth. So the bishop believed that it made sense to try to calculate on what day the world began. Because the Bible is intended to be taken as history. Moses was a real character, historical. But with mythology, we don't ask such questions. It doesn't make sense to ask, what was Zeus's birthday? It's an inappropriate question. So mythology takes place in what we call primordial time. That's different from chronological time, calendar time, our kind of time. Now, let me say the kinds of questions that we'll deal with. The Egyptians had many myths, and they had different myths for different occasions. I'm going to try to show you how the Egyptians presented the beginning of the universe and the question of life after death, how they answered that. So let's start in the very beginning. Now, for the Egyptians, in the beginning was water. And in the primordial waters were eight gods. Now, the eight gods are called the Ogdoad, O-G-D-O-A-D. It's just eight. These gods came in pairs, so to speak, a husband and wife or a male and a female. And they had attributes. So in these primordial waters were these eight gods, four pairs. You had Huk and Huket. Now, their attribute was formlessness. Formlessness. Now, if you want to remember which is the male and which is the female of the pair, the female always ends in a T, the letter T. So Huk is the male, Huket is the female. Nice thing, by the way, about the Egyptian language. Every Egyptian word that's feminine ends in a T. Unlike, say, French, when you're always trying to figure out why is this masculine and why is this, you don't have to worry about it in Egypt. Everything ends in a T if it's feminine. So Huk and Huket are the first pair, their formlessness. Then comes Kuk and Kuket. Darkness. Amun and Amunet are next. Hiddenness. Now, Amun is later going to become a very important god in ancient Egypt. The most important. But that's thousands of years off. That's when we're going to have the pharaoh Amunhotep, whose name means Amun is pleased. So we've got three pairs so far. The last, the fourth pair, is Nun and Nunet. Nun is the primordial waters, the waters themselves, and his consort, Nunet. Now, the important thing about this myth is to gather what, just what, are the Egyptians trying to tell us? I mean, eight gods in the water? No. They're telling us more. Think about the attributes. Formlessness, darkness, hiddenness. In the beginning was chaos. These are not sort of user-friendly terms. Hiddenness, darkness, formlessness. They're not positive attributes. They're negative. So in the beginning, we have chaos. And that's the eight. That's the beginning of the universe. But we don't have people yet. And we don't have gods in the Egyptian sense of gods that can interact with people. These eight gods are often shown as having the heads of frogs because they're water deities. But we don't know any more about them, really, except their attributes. But then, the moment of creation takes place. Out of the waters arises the primordial hill, a mound of earth. Now, up and down Egypt, they built temples. And every temple claimed, we're built on the primordial hill. Right? So they wanted a kind of primacy. But the myth says there was a primordial hill. And standing on that primordial hill was a god, Atum. Now, Atum is a special god. He begins the other gods. He creates the gods that interact with earth. He is called the self-created. Right? I mean, how did Atum get there? Created himself. And then Atum, by himself, has two children. Now, what's going to happen is Atum is going to have, lead to a total of eight gods. Atum plus the eight are called the nine, the Aeneid. Nine just means the Aeneid. So Atum starts it all off, and who are his children? Shu and Tefnut. Shu is air. And as you know, he's the male, right? Because Tefnut ends in the T. So Shu is air. Tefnut is moisture. So what the myth is telling us that in the beginning, we have air and moisture. Now, it's kind of interesting to compare myths. I like to compare them. Think about the first line of Genesis. I'll just read it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the earth was a formless void. There was darkness over the deep. Notice, there's a similarity that in the beginning is formless void, darkness. Now, of course, the Egyptian myth is thousands of years earlier than the Old Testament. And we'll see possible borrowings from Egyptian mythology and Christianity and Judaism. But the point is, people seem to agree the beginning was a scary time. But now we have Shu and Tefnut, air and moisture. Next, they have two children. Geb and Nut. Again, you know who the female is, Nut. Geb is earth. Geb is earth. Nut is the sky goddess. Nut is sometimes shown in tombs, and it's a wonderful painting of her sometimes, on royal tombs. She's shown on the ceiling of a tomb. And what she's doing is she's bending over with her arms kind of down one wall and her legs down another. Her belly is the ceiling, and it shows the stars on her belly. And what Nut does is she swallows the sun in the evening. It travels through her, and she gives birth to it in the morning. So you get this notion of birth and rebirth. So we have now air and moisture, and we have earth and sky. Compare that with the Greeks, by the way. Remember the Greeks had four basic elements? They had fire, air, water, and earth. Right? There are similarities. Interestingly, by the way, for the Greeks, fire was a very special element. It's the only of the four elements that animals don't live in. Animals lived in the earth, in the air, in the water, but not in fire. And fire in later ages will become a crucial element. But we have the Egyptian myth. Now, we've got Geb and Nut, sky and earth. There's even a sidebar to this myth where you got a story of how air becomes a little jealous of Geb and Nut and squeezes in between, right? So you get the air between the heavens and the earth. Anyway, they give birth to four gods who are central to Egyptian mythology. They give birth to Isis and Osiris, who are brother and sister, naturally, husband and wife. By the way, I said that every Egyptian name that's feminine ends in a T, but I said Isis, that doesn't end in a T. That's because we know her name from the Greeks. Her real name in Egyptian is East, I-S-T. But the Greeks, when they came and add their I-S endings, it becomes Isis. Right? So sometimes it won't sound right, but it is in ancient Egyptian. Isis and Osiris are brother and sister, husband and wife. This, by the way, will justify what pharaohs do later in marrying their own sisters. Right? So we're going to get a lot from this myth. Now, they have a brother and sister also. There are four children here involved. They are Set and Nephthys. Now, Seth, it's sometimes Set, called Set, sometimes Seth, same god. He's the male. And Nephthys, Greek version, Nephthys, are also brother and sister, husband and wife. These four, the Isis, Osiris, Seth, and Nephthys, are going to be crucial. And I want to explain to you today the myth of Isis and Osiris. According to the myth, now remember, in a myth, you're supposed to listen carefully and you'll get the message. You will see at the end of this myth, you will get almost all of the basics of the Egyptian belief in life after death. Isis and Osiris are the good guys. They are elementally good gods, want to do well. Nephthys also, their sister, is the good goddess. But Seth is elementally evil. He is the archetype of the devil, only tries to do harm. Now, according to the myth, Isis and Osiris come down to earth to civilize Egypt. Now, remember when we talked about prehistory? What does civilization mean? It means domesticating animals. It means raising crops. So we learn that the origins of civilization, domestication of crops and animals, comes from Egypt. Right? Egypt is the source. At least that's what the Egyptians said. Now, Isis and Osiris do such a good job of civilizing Egypt, bringing civilization to the people of the Nile Valley, that Osiris goes away to teach the rest of the world how to do these things. So we get the diffusion of civilization from Egypt to other lands. Now, while Osiris is away, Seth tries to do horrible things to Egypt. But fortunately, Isis is very powerful. She is the goddess of magic. She is even called she who knows all the names. Now, what that means is, if you wanted to do a magic spell against somebody, I would have to know your name. So I could say, may this happen to Megan, for example. May this happen to Marvin. Now, Isis knows everybody's name. When an Egyptian kid was born, they often had two names. One was the real name, and only his mother knew that name. The other name was a name that everybody knew. So, for example, if we name you Marvin, but we really call you Harry, everybody knows you by Harry, and if somebody tries to do an evil spell on you and says, oh, may Harry break his leg, it won't work because your name is really Marvin. So Isis, as having the name she who knows everyone's name, means nobody is out of her range. She is the superhero. So Isis, who is powerful, keeps our evil brother Seth in check. Nothing terrible happens to Egypt. And then Osiris returns, having civilized other countries. Now, Seth, though, is always scheming, and he lays a plan. While Osiris is sleeping, while his brother is sleeping, he takes his exact measurements, his bodily measurements, and he builds a wooden chest to those exact proportions, exactly to the proportion of Osiris. And at a banquet, he says, I'll give a wonderful prize to anybody who fits exactly into this chest. And guest after guest tries, doesn't quite fit, it's a little too big, a little too small. It's very much like Cinderella's slipper. And finally, Osiris tries. And it fits him just right, of course. But Seth is ready. And he nails the chest shut, pours molten lead on the chest, and throws it into the Nile. And Osiris dies in the chest. Now, interesting, by the way, there is no contradiction involved in someone being a god and dying. He is a god, greater than man, but mortal. So in the chest, Osiris dies. But the myth doesn't end there. The Nile flows northwards to the Mediterranean, and the chest washes ashore on the island of Byblos, modern Lebanon. And according to the myth, there's this huge storm, and the chest is blown into the branches of a tree where the dead Osiris is. Now, the tree grows to tremendous proportions, encompassing the chest in the trunk. The king of Byblos wants to build a palace, and he needs large trees, cedars of Lebanon. He needs large trees for pillars. And this tree is cut down and incorporated into the palace. It becomes a pillar. So we get the strange situation of Osiris in a chest and a pillar in a palace. But that's the way it is. But Isis, the devoted wife, sets out on a journey to recover the body of her husband. She eventually finds out where Osiris is in this pillar in the palace, talks to the queen of Byblos, gets a job as her handmaiden, talks to the queen, and explains, my husband is in this pillar in the palace. The queen is sympathetic. The pillar is cut down. The chest is taken out, and Osiris is indeed there, dead. Isis brings the body back to Egypt for proper burial. But Set, always scheming, finds the body. He finds the properly buried body of Osiris and hacks it into 13 pieces. Scatters them up and down the Nile. There are different places where different pieces are buried. Isis, wanting to give her husband the proper burial, finds the pieces. She is aided by her sister Nephthys, who wants to help. They find almost all of the pieces of Osiris. The phallus is missing. It was thrown into the Nile and devoured by fish. Actually, it's interesting, they even, in the myth, the name of the fish, the name of the three fish that devour the phallus is given. It's quite interesting because the fish are electric, mildly electric, so I think they were special. So anyway, the phallus is devoured, but Isis finds the other 12 pieces, reassembles Osiris, fashions an artificial phallus for Osiris, so he's complete, says magical words, and breathes life into Osiris. She takes the form of a bird. There are many scenes of her taking the form of a bird, hovering over her husband, and Osiris resurrects. He becomes the first person ever to resurrect. And as a resurrected one, he becomes the god of the dead. So Osiris is the god of the dead. In a sense, he's the first mummy. Now, what are we supposed to learn from this myth? I mean, supposed to listen carefully and get the message. Well, as I said, almost every funerary belief that the Egyptians had can be traced from this. For example, it is crucial for Isis to recover the body and bury it on Egyptian soil. That's why she goes to Byblos. There is something special about Egypt and Egyptian soil. This, by the way, is why the Egyptians never colonized. They never, when they conquered a foreign country, set up a big colony. Nobody wanted to die away from Egypt. You had to be brought back to Egypt, mummified, buried in the soil. So the first thing is, you have to be buried in Egyptian soil. Next, he was missing one part, the phallus. She creates an artificial phallus. You must be complete. Because if you're going to resurrect, if you're going to use this body again in the next world, you want it to be complete. So you have to have a complete body. This, by the way, was a practice that was followed by Egyptian embalmers. When a person died who had only one leg, who had a leg amputated, they would create an artificial leg, an early prosthetic device, but for the next world. So we're also learning that you have to be complete. Now, think about the chest that Seth fashions. It's to the exact proportions of Osiris. This is going to become later the anthropoid coffin, those coffins that we're so familiar with in Egyptian that are shaped like a man. That chest in the Osiris myth becomes the anthropoid coffin. So we have also the belief that there's going to be a special container for the body that is going to preserve it. And if you have that special container, that coffin, if you are complete, if your body is whole, if you're buried on Egyptian soil, then like Osiris, you too can resurrect and go to the next world. So it's a very, very important myth. And it doesn't even end there. Isis and Osiris have a child, Horus, who does battle with his evil uncle, Seth, who has killed his father. And one of the important things that we get out of this battle is he defeats Seth. He beats him in battle. But two things happen. One is Horus's eye is taken out in the battle, but it's magically regenerated. So good triumphs. But the other important thing from that battle is that Horus defeats Seth, but he doesn't kill him. And I think it's a little bit like, and there's a message there, it's a little bit like Star Wars, where till the very end, you remember Darth Vader always gets away? I think it's an existential statement. Evil will always be with us. We have to be vigilant. That's why Seth isn't killed in the myth. There's a real basic truth that they're telling you. But this is a crucial thing for the Egyptians, mythology. I don't think they meant it literally. I don't think they meant you're supposed to really believe this actually happened. But you're getting certain basic truths. Every deceased person, after he was dead, was called by his own name and Osiris. So, for example, your name might be Ani Osiris. Nachmin Osiris. The idea was you wanted to be associated with Osiris. Osiris resurrected, and we call you Osiris, you too will resurrect. So the myth tells us, I mean, the long myth, the myth from the waters of chaos to the Isis and Osiris myth, it tells us the world began with chaos. Eventually it was peopled by gods, which give you some order. We do have the good guy winning in the end. And it also tells us if you behave properly, take the right precautions, you'll be resurrected. There is a life after death. And this is a myth. So that's mythology. But remember I said I wanted to do three things. I wanted to do mythology, I wanted to do religion, and I wanted to do philosophy. And let me say how religion differs. Religion, same questions are handled by religion as mythology. Is there life after death? Various religions give the answer. Christianity will say yes. Judaism doesn't say anything about it. Jewish religion doesn't have anything about life after death. But the important thing about a religious belief is that, one, there's an element of faith. It involves belief. If someone says, I believe in life after death because that's my religion, that ends it. That's the element of belief, and that's fine. But also, we're supposed to believe religious stories in a historical way. These aren't just myths. So, for example, when Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt, that's believed to be a historical event. Whereas in mythology, it doesn't make sense to say, what was Zeus's birthday? It does make sense to say, what was Moses's birthday? We may not know the answer, but it's a meaningful question because in religion, the belief is that a character like Moses actually existed. unlike, say, the Greeks got it on Mount Olympus. In a sense, one man's mythology may be another person's religion, but the crucial thing is, mythology doesn't take place in historical time. Religion does. Now, what about the third category I said? Philosophy. Well, philosophy tries to do the same thing, answer the same questions. Is there life after death? How did the universe begin? But it does it differently from either mythology or religion. Philosophy requires proof. You cannot in philosophy simply say, that's what I believe. It requires proof. Now the question is, how do you get such proof? How do you prove that there's life after death? Well, philosophers have tried. For example, René Descartes was a religious person, but he tried to prove logically that God must exist. Now, the point I want to make is a point that usually when I'm in a large classroom and I'm presenting to my students, they're all ready to kill me after I say what I'm going to say. But I'm going to try to make it clear that I think maybe, hopefully, you'll come around to the way I view it. Philosophical questions like, is there life after death? Is there a God? Are not matters of opinion. There is a right and wrong answer. Many people think, oh, no, philosophy is just say anything off the top of your head. No. Now, let me try to convince you. I know a lot of you are going, maybe not. I don't think so. Whether there is life after death or not is not a matter of a belief or opinion. It's a fact. Either there is life after death or there isn't. It doesn't matter whether you don't know the answer. That's different from it not being answerable. For example, we may not know how many people are in the next room, but there are either 7 people in the next room or there aren't. And life after death is a question like that. We can't settle it empirically. We can't observe right now, but it has an answer. So philosophical questions have answers. We shouldn't think that they don't. We shouldn't think that they don't. And they're very important. Now, some people may be skeptical that they can be answered. That I can understand. But let me suggest that I think they can. Philosophers try to answer questions. For example, one, everybody's wondered about the beginning of the universe. I'm sure you all wondered about it. How did it begin? Well, science says the Big Bang, the basic theory that in the beginning, everything was in a tightly balled mass. All the mass of the universe was in this thing about the size of a golf ball. Then it explodes, and the rest is the laws of physics. But that's not the question that philosophers ask about the beginning of the universe. The real question is, how did that golf ball get there? What was there before the golf ball? Now, as an example, to show you that these questions are answerable and how we might proceed to answer it and how it's different from religion, which just ends with belief, think about this. There are only 2 possibilities for the beginning of the universe. One is, it doesn't have a beginning. As far back as you go in time, there was always something. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the universe did begin at a time, and it began out of nothing. At time t0, there was nothing. At time t1, poof, there was something. Almost by magic. It's called ex nihilo. Latin, out of nothing. Those are the only 2 possibilities. Either something came out of nothing, or there was always something. Now, think about it. Just by this simple, kind of simple-minded philosophical exercise, we're almost at the answer to how did the universe begin. We've limited to 2 possibilities, and now the question is, can we eliminate one of those possibilities? Is one of those impossible? And if one of those is impossible, if we could show that, then we know the other one must be true, and we've philosophically answered the question of how did the universe begin. Now, I'm not going to deal with which one's possible or not. Let you figure that out. But let me say this. Philosophical questions are important and have answers. Now, what we need to know is, did the Egyptians do philosophy? There's no question about it. They did mythology. We know about their myths. Plenty of religion. We have religious texts. We don't have any philosophical texts. That is a question that people are still debating. Could a civilization as advanced as Egypt have created such masterpieces of art, such incredible, you know, works of art and temples, and not done philosophy? One possibility is they just didn't write it down. It was so special. that they didn't want it to commit it to papyrus. It's a possibility, but we're not sure. But the important thing is to get clear the differences between mythology, religion, and philosophy, and that certainly mythology and religion were a central part of the Egyptian mind. Now, next time, what I'd like to do is tell you about the beginnings of Egyptology, how we learn all this stuff, and it all began with Napoleon Bonaparte going to Egypt. So I'll see you next time.